Hare Krishna. So today we come to the last part of our discussion on this three-part series in world religions. So this is, Islam is a sensitive and volatile topic. So if after this class you are going to share any of this, please don't share anything out of context. It'll unnecessarily create some provocation. Both within and without. So now, within means among our community or outside the community also. So I'll talk about this primarily in terms of first a historical analysis, about how Islam originated, and then we'll talk in terms of the socio-political way in which Islam has manifested, because that is what is most visible in society. And through it all, we'll also adopt the same approach we adopted yesterday. Look at the facts, look at how Muslims understand them, and look at how we see it from a Shastric Vedic perspective. So let's start first with the life of Muhammad. As I told earlier, Islam was also part of the messianic tradition where they expected a Masiha to come. And people were expecting some person who would come and deliver them. So, till almost the age of 40, Muhammad lived a normal life. Normal in the sense that he was a pious person. He was he faced a lot of sufferings in his life. He was brought up by his parents were not there. And at the age of 40, he used to retreat in the caves for solitude. And suddenly, once he was in the cave, he suddenly felt, write. He heard a voice, write. He says, I can't write. He says, write. Can't write. Write. And he was impelled to write. So it said that the Archangel Gabriel, he spoke to him the words of the Quran. So Quran is not a book that was spoken at one particular time. At different times, Muhammad even would go into some kind of trance. And at that time, the spirit would, Gabriel or God, whoever it is, would speak through him. And he spoke different verses at different times. And later all of them will recollect those to whom he had spoken. He put them all together. They put him all together several years after his death. And when it was all put together, that was what was called as the Quran. So now, when he started getting these revelations, he started sharing them. Initially, he himself was skeptical, what this is. But his fortune had changed when he had married Khadija, who was a successful businesswoman for whom he had been working earlier. She was much older to him. But then they got attracted, he got married, and he also became very wealthy thereafter. So she persuaded him that actually, God, Allah is choosing you as a messenger. And then as he was living, his teachings, now, what he taught in the through the Quran, some of it was spiritually uplifting, some of it was socially agitating. There's much of, if we consider the Arabic society at that time, there was much that was led to some kind of social reform. From where people were, they got elevated. But he was in Mecca and he had to, his teachings provoked a lot of hostility and he had to flee to Medina. So there, when he fled to Medina, a group of people accompanied him. And he eventually settled in Medina. And while he was living in Medina, he consolidated. He acquired a good number of following. He fought many different wars. Eventually, he came back and conquered Mecca. So in some of the wars, it said although he was outnumbered, suddenly some forces mysteriously appeared. That's the story, that they appeared and they helped him win the war. And when he was losing war and still he won the war, that's when his followers got the faith that actually he's divinely empowered. So while he was in Mecca, throughout there was a revelation that he got. When he initially was in Mecca, some revelation he got which was in Medina. And in general, the initial revelation that he got, it is more moderate. The later revelation that he has got, it's more extreme. And this is, again, general statements. It's not categorical. But at one particular point, he spoke some verses. And he went into a trance, he spoke some verses. And afterwards, so those verses were about, because there are some existing conceptions of God who were being worshipped, some idols that were being worshipped over there. Some existing conceptions of God were there. And those verses talked about some way of reconciling with the people who had some other forms of worship, other conceptions of worship. And after some time, Muhammad said, no, actually, that was not Allah speaking through me. That was the Satan speaking through me. So that is not a part of the Quran. So Salman Rushdie took those verses and wrote his book called the Satanic Verses. So the idea is that the revelation that he got, he put it all together, and that was what became the Quran. Now eventually when the Quran was compiled together, it has 114 chapters, which are called as surahs, comprised of verses, which is called ayahs. And now they have different surahs which have different, this is an elaborate seminar, I won't be able to go through all of it, but this is just a general understanding. So they have different sections which are significant for different times and places. And the whole idea of the Quran is that it is considered to be literally present in heaven the way it is now. And they consider the Quran is non-translatable. Although it is translated, but they say the Quran, it is, there is no difference between the letter, like we have the word and we have a letter of law and spirit of the law. So, but in according to Orthodox Islam, actually, it is the letter of the law and the spirit of the law are same, because they consider the letter itself to be the spirit. So in that sense, the Orthodox understanding of Islam is very literalist. The word, the Quran is considered to be literally as it is present in heaven, that is manifested over here. Now the Quran is not a very big book. Now along with that, there is also what are called the hadiths. These are the life story of Muhammad, along with the other sayings, how he dealt with different people at different times. And this is a major source of Islamic teaching for the Muslims in general. So the Quran is the source, it's considered fundamental, but often for most practical purposes, the hadiths that are the source. So Muhammad himself during his life was remarkably successful in his political conquests. And although he was just, he started off as an assistant of a trader, eventually he went on to become a powerful conqueror. But like in all other situations, whenever there is a powerful ruler, powerful, wealthy person, after he departs, there is a huge succession struggle that emerges. And the succession struggle in Islam was especially bitter. So, what happened was, now, again this is a little complicated. Yes. Basically, when Muhammad left Mecca to come to Medina, Mecca was the place where he was living, from where he was persecuted and he had to flee. There were several attempts to assassinate him, and he managed to leave from there. So the people who came with him, they are called the Muhajirs. And they came with him, and when he came to Medina, many of the local people allied with him. They are the Ansaris. And now these two were a very diverse group of people. They were occupationally they were different. And they were culturally they were different. But Muhammad, much of his time he had to spend in reconciling the various groups of followers who were following him. And after he died, who would be his successor? That became a matter of violent struggle. So the successor of Muhammad was called as the Caliph. The kingdom which he established is Caliphate. So one of the persons who accompanied Muhammad from Mecca to Medina was Abu Bakr. And he became the first Caliph. Now what happened was, a cousin of Muhammad was Ali. And Ali was very close to Muhammad. And many people expected Ali to become the successor. But Ali was sidelined, and Abu Bakr became Abu Bakr after him, another Muhajir, that is Umar ibn al-Khattab and Uthman ibn Affan, they all became successor. Eventually, after Uthman, Ali became the successor. Now if you see, the time for which they lived were not much. After they became the caliphs, most of the initial successors to Muhammad were assassinated. It was a very violent period after that. And now when Ali became the successor, relatively speaking, Ali was a little more moderate kind of person. But Ali was also assassinated eventually. And then now Uthman was one of the leaders who had lost power to Ali. And one of Ali's successors was Hassan. He's also Hassan ibn Ali. He was the grandson of Muhammad. And Uthman's followers, they attacked and they assassinated Ali. Now this Ali is Hussein ibn Ali. That is the grandson of Muhammad. So according to Islamic legend, when the soldiers were actually killing Hassan, they hesitated. Because they knew he was the grandson of Muhammad. How can we kill him? But they were ordered and they killed him. And when he was killed, that created an irrevocable split. And that's how there was the split between the Shias and the Sunnis. The Shias are the followers of Ali. And the Shias often have this ritual of self-flagellation. On a particular day, they call it the day of Ashura. When Hussein ibn Ali was killed, they often flogged themselves publicly. So their idea was, they had the forces. The Shias, they had the forces by which they could have stopped Uthman's aggressors. Uthman's followers were attacking. But they thought that Hussein ibn Ali, he would never be killed because he was the grandson of Muhammad. That no matter how much the animosity, nobody would dare to attack and kill him. So they did not come to defend him at that time. And because they did not come to defend him, they mortify themselves in as atonement for that activity. So anyway, this is the split within Islam. So the followers of Ali are Shias, everyone else is Sunnis. Now, majority of Muslims, large number of them are Sunnis. Shias also there in some pockets. In some countries, they are more prominent. Now, subsequently, as Islam spread more and more, the political expansion of Islam, both eastwards and westwards, it is one of the most remarkable political conquests in world history. Few religions or few kingdoms have spread so rapidly and so far as has Islam. And there was a French king who stopped the Islamic invasion into Europe. Otherwise, all of Europe would also have fallen. So they spread to Europe, they spread to Africa, they spread to India. And they were very successful in their political conquests. Now, their reason, their rationale was, they were all convinced that they were following Muhammad. And Muhammad was the chosen prophet. As I said earlier, Muhammad, he declared that he was the seal of all prophets. That means earlier, Moses had come, Jesus had come, and Muhammad had come now. So Muhammad said that, I am the last prophet. There will be no more prophets after me. So they felt that we got the special messenger of God with us. We have got his power with us. And we have God's power with us. And we are going to conquer the world and bring it to the service of God. So there was definitely a religious zeal to their political ambitions. But if we look at the local history, many of these political leaders were also politicians. They were power hungry. And religion gave them the zeal to direct that hunger for power and invoke or incite or inspire, whichever you want to look at it, their followers to fight. Now, in Islam, there is the concept of jihad. Jihad is basically holy war. Now, the word jihad is understood in different ways at different levels. So one of the prominent meanings that Islamic theologians give is it is an inner war. It is a war against our own lower desires. It is a war by which every Muslim has to fight so that they can live righteously. So Islam also has five fundamental principles. They should give charity, they should do namaz every day, they should go to Mecca at least once a year. They have principles. And what are principles they have? To follow those principles requires one to fight inner war. One of the fundamental principles, they should accept only one God and no God other than that one God. So now, they have the principle of shirk. I'll come to that a little later. That to identify anything other than God as God, that is considered a great sin. So there's an inner war to be fought to avoid the temptations and to follow the principles. That is the understanding of jihad. But there is also what is called a defensive war. That means if somebody is trying to follow Islam and others try to stop a person from following Islam, then if they defend themselves at that time, that is also jihad. Because they are just as they will fight against inner enemies in order to protect one's capacity to practice Islam. Similarly, if there are outer enemies who stop us from practicing Islam, then we fight against them also. Now, the third meaning, the aggressive war, the war of aggression, there is a major disconnect in Islam between the intellectuals and the political class. I'll come to this a little later. But the point is that the intellectuals say that actually the aggressive war is not considered to be jihad. But politically speaking, jihad has been used as a war of aggression. And the rationalization that they use is that we are expanding Islam. Because if we don't expand Islam, then those who are not Muslims, they will attack us. They are anyway culturally attacking us, they are demonizing us. They are the enemies of Islam. If they are not curbed, they will curb us. So this war is also, the rationalization is also a defensive war. So for them, jihad is a righteous doctrine. They said that they have the idea of martyrdom. That if somebody dies in jihad while fighting for the sake of Allah, a holy war, that person will enter into paradise and enjoy many pleasures in paradise. So this idea of pleasures in paradise doesn't come in the Quran. It comes in Hadith. And there are passages where it is said that the persons who die in jihad, they will get 73 virgins to enjoy for all of eternity. Now, for people who are poverty stricken and people who don't have much resources to even basically live, this just triggers their sensual imagination. And this incites people. So this aggressive war is also part of jihad. Although in terms of scriptural understanding, that was not what was in the Quran as it is traditionally understood, but it is also an operational principle. I'll come to that a little later, more in detail. Now another problematic idea within Islam is taqiyya, what they call it. Taqiyya is deception as a religious virtue. That means while you are fighting a war, if your enemy is more powerful than you, you need to defeat the enemy, you can deceive the enemy. And because you are doing it for a good cause, so their idea is that if the ends are good, then the means don't matter. Whatever means you use, that's all good because the ends are good. And in this, they draw on the example of Muhammad himself. Muhammad, as I said, he was a spiritual teacher, but he was also a political leader. And the political leader, often he did things which the Bhagavad Gita says, in this world, every endeavor is covered by fault. So there were things which he did which could be questionable. So for example, at one time, the Jews, there was hostility between the Muslims and the Jews, followers of Muhammad and the Jews. And there are fights going on. There was one group of Jews which fought and they were killed. The other group of Jews, they said they wanted peace. And Muhammad had sent a message that if you surrender, we will give you, we will protect you. So they surrendered, they laid down their weapons, they surrendered, and Muhammad massacred all of them. So when this happened, now there are different versions of this history, but it's clear that there are times when Muhammad himself acted in ways which were, especially in warfare, he acted in ways which were less than exemplary. So now, this leads to a major problem for Islam. See, there is power itself can corrupt, but when different powers are mixed up, the corruption becomes much more. In general, in the Vedic tradition, there's always been a separation between, say, spiritual or intellectual power and political or martial power. The Brahmanas who have spiritual power, who have intellectual power. And the Kshatriyas who have political power, who have martial power. In all religions, the separation has been there. Now, Buddha was the spiritual teacher. The main person who propagated Buddhism was Ashoka. And he was a king. Now, Jesus was like a spiritual teacher. To some extent, Paul was the statesman who propagated Jesus, Christianity a lot. And later, the Constantine and other emperors, they used the resources of the Roman Empire to spread Christianity. Now, Muhammad, however, was both the spiritual and the political leader. Now, as far as his trances, his devotion to God, his examples of saintliness are there, they are there in the Hadith. His teachings of devotion to God are there in the Quran. And at the same time, there are his examples that while acting in the world, he often acted as a politician. So now, subsequently, there is the example of Muhammad as a Brahmana, as a spiritual teacher, and there's the example of Muhammad as a martial leader. Now, in Islam, there is a intrinsic mixing of political and religious power. The caliphate was considered to be a theocracy, that it is considered a holy kingdom. And that's why we saw that most of the successors of Muhammad, they were all political rulers. And they were all subjected to political intrigues, political assassinations. So there has been a strong mixing of the political and the spiritual. So what has happened is, at a social level, the political example of Muhammad has been emulated by the political leaders much more than his spiritual example. So at an individual level, there are many Muslims who practice Islam as a pious way, as a pious way of living and a pious way of moving towards God. But at a social level, at a socio-political level, the leaders of Muslims often talk about the example of Muhammad as a politician. And thus, at a social level, as a socio-political level, Islam becomes less a search for God, less a religious search for God, and more a religious search for power, or a political search for power. And in being a political search for power, often a lot of things which are less than laudable happen in that. So now within the Sunnis, there is a sect called the Wahhabis. And these are known to be especially ferocious. So now if you consider terrorism as it exists today, this is something which is as is terrorizing the world. But how did it emerge? It's not that it is endemic to Islam. The first terrorists or first suicide bombers, if you want to use the word specifically, the first suicide bombers in the world in the modern times were actually from the LTTE in Sri Lanka. They used a suicide bombing as a means of fighting against the Sinhalese government. They were one of the suicide bombers. He assassinated Rajiv Gandhi also. So now the concept of suicide bombing was started with the LTTE, but then that was picked up by the Islamic terrorists. When they felt that now Islam, like when the West colonized the world, The Middle East was also colonized to some extent. And they felt that the Western culture, the Western civilization is hostile to Islam. And of course, I'll come to the Indian Hindu civilization later. But they felt that we are surrounded by enemies and we have to fight against them. And using this principle of taqiyya, that, you know, by hook or by crook, we have to fight against them. So now, if you see terrorism, especially killing innocent people, suicide bombing, now this is, there is no holiness in this war. If you consider from the Vedic perspective, there is the Kshatriyas, when they fight, first of all, Kshatriyas never fight against civilians. The Kurukshetra war, it is a war which took place not in the cities, it took place in a field, Kurukshetra. So, soldiers always fight against soldiers. Soldiers never fight against civilians. And even when soldiers are fighting against soldiers, they fight against equals. An elephant warrior will not attack an ordinary foot soldier. So, the fight is among people who are trained to fight, people who have the weapon, who are equally skilled to fight, and people who are alert. So, it is not that if a soldier is looking somewhere else, you attack at that time. But the terror is, what they do is exactly the opposite of all this. They attack civilians, they attack people who are not at all trained and who are not at all alert. So, this is completely, from the philosophical perspective, this is tamasic. We discuss about the mode of goodness, passion, ignorance. This is completely in the mode of ignorance. The nearest anything similar to modern terrorism that we find in the Vedic scriptures is Ashwatthama's killing the sons of the Pandavas and the other Pandava warriors at night while they were sleeping. And that action was so reprehensible that even Duryodhana condemns it. So that is, this is completely reprehensible, but this has been used as a major instrument of war by some group of Islamic terrorists, some group of Muslim people, and then its use has spread to other people also. So now there is, as I said, there is one aspect of this is the war for self-defense, the war for aggression, and the mixing of the political and the spiritual. Now when it comes to Islam's interaction with Hinduism, you know, there is an additional factor that comes in over here. That is that Islam, among all the three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, Islam is the most strongest against idolatry. Idolatry is the worship of the images of God. So one of the principles of Islam is that, you know, you should worship Allah Akbar, their prayer with the singing namaz. That has multiple meaning. There are a lot of things in it, but the main thing is that you should worship only one God and no one other than that one God. So now they say that associating any imagery with God, that is what they call this shirk. It's a sin. That's a great sin. So now when Muhammad, he had left Mecca to go to Medina, when he conquered Mecca back again, the first thing that he did on entering Mecca is he destroyed all the idols over there. And he saw that as an activity by which he established the worship of the one true God. And in the Quran, idolatry is considered as the greatest of sins. Not murder, not any kind of bloodshed. They are all forgivable. But the sin of idolatry is considered unforgivable. Idolaters are bound to go to hell. That's their idea. Now, why are they so strongly against idolatry? Here we have to understand philosophically what is happening. See, there are idols and there are deities. The Archa Vigraha is called as Archa Avatar. We understand that the deity is a manifestation of God. And God himself manifests in this world. Whereas there, because in these traditions, in the Abrahamic religions in general, and especially in Islam, there is no positive description of God. Because there is no positive description of God, they hold that any representation of God that is there, that is a product of imagination. And people say, so God is here and his representation is here. Now some people may say this representation has come up simply by imagination. And some people may say, no, actually, okay, you need to have some representation of God so that you can worship God. So, the representation of God may be a route to God. But their argument is that people, when they get a representation, they start worshipping the representation itself. And then they forget what is being represented. So, the representation might seem to be like a route to God, but eventually that representation becomes a competitor to God. Because they feel that God is beyond representation, and the representation becomes the object of worship, and they stop worshipping God and they start worshipping simply the representation. And when anything becomes a competition to God, then that has to be destroyed so that the one true God will be worshipped. So that's why they consider destroying idols, destroying any representation of God, as an act of great religious virtue. Because by this, they are establishing, they are stopping, finishing off the worship of the false gods, so that the true worship of the true God can be established. Now, because of this, there have been a lot of desecration of temples in India. And as I said, that not only Hindus and Buddhists also had a lot of iconography. They would have huge images of Buddha. And they were all destroyed by the Muslims. Now, when this happened, I'll talk a little bit about terrorism in terms of killing innocent people. That is a activity of extremists who are not large in number, but they are very vocal. So I'll come to that a little later. But as far as the condemnation of deity worship is concerned, that is not an act of religious extremism in Islam. That is a core belief of Islam. So it is not that only extremist Muslims will destroy idols. It is that is something which is repeatedly talked about in a celebratory tone in Islamic texts. So the antipathy towards idol worship is very strong in Islam. And in Indian history, there have been different rulers who, if we consider India was ruled by the Britishers and India was also ruled by Muslims. There's a significant difference between the rules. You know, when Muslims came to India, they ruled India, and many Muslims made India into their home. They lived over here. Now for Britishers, when they came to India, there are some Anglican Indians. But for most of them, India was not their home. In fact, if we look at the British occupation of India from the British perspective, now for many Britishers, to be posted in India was like a punishment for them. See, India is such a hot country filled with so much disease, so much poverty, so much mess. So they considered it, they never made India into their home. Now both these religions, they converted a lot of people. Muslims, many places, so now when Muhammad, he conquered various territories, and many people converted to his beliefs. Those who did not convert, he imposed a heavy tax on them. Their idea was that if you have to live under us, and you are not following our faith, then you have to pay an extra tax. So that was a principle that was followed by many Muslim rulers in India. Some Muslim rulers were extremists and they persecuted those who did not convert also. And most of the Muslims who are there in India now, you see, they are Muslims who were the people who came as aggressors from other places to India. But they were not all that much in number. But they conquered India, and then many people in India itself, they converted to Islam. So many of the Muslims in India are actually, if we go back to their ancestry, they are Indians. But they converted for various reasons, for whatever it was. But the antipathy towards idolatry that was there, that was a central feature in Islam. Now, moving forwards, there is, in the Western world, as well as in the media in general, there is a strong tendency towards political correctness where people try to get Islam entirely off the hook. And they say, whenever any terrorists do anything, they say that actually, you know, the former president of America, he would not even use the name Islam for referring to Islamic ISIS. He would try to avoid using the name Islam. So people bend backwards to avoid ascribing any blame to Islam. There's the tendency towards political correctness where terrorism is seen as an extreme fringe activity which has got nothing to do with Islam. Now, why is it like this? I was reading an article in The Guardian after this Manchester attack was there. So The Guardian says, actually, if you look at there were the homegrown jihadis. Homegrown jihadis means that there were people who were born and brought up in England, but then they became Muslims and they became jihadis. So they said that actually, if you look at their profiles, no, it is not that Islam made them violent. Rather, they were themselves violent and then they embraced Islam. And they acted violently in the name of Islam. So basically, the whole attempt is to not ascribe blame to Islam in any way, to ascribe blame to factors other than Islam. Social factors, psychological factors, economic factors. Now, all these do play a role. Now, when there's this attempt to bend backwards politically, there's a reason for that. See, we are living in what is called as the postmodern world. And in the postmodern world, modernity was characterized by a lot of faith in science. But after the the Second World War, especially nuclear bomb, the atom bomb was exploded. So after the harmful effects of technology started becoming evident, the potential dangers, so people no longer have such uncritical faith in science, especially in the Western world. So now it is the whole focus in the postmodern ethos is on social justice. That is, nobody should be discriminated against. That nobody should be unfairly labeled because of things which are beyond their control. So Islam is seen as a prime candidate for social justice. Because Islamophobia, you know, because some people in Islam do some terrorist activities, and because of that, you know, whole of Muslims, to label them as bad, it's not correct. And so the mainstream media, even when there are acts of Islamic terror, they try to deflect the cause to other things. This is the overall ethos. Now, I'm not saying, I'll come to it later whether it is right or wrong. We have to understand that every phase in human history has a particular tenor, particular ethos. So there are many examples of this. As I said, in Australia, as well as in America, when the colonizers went, they destroyed the natives over there. But the example of this mood of social justice was that in the early part of the 21st century, you know, the Australians came together and they all together, almost 20,000 or 200,000 Australians, they marched on the Sydney Harbour Bridge and they apologized to the Aborigines. The way we treated you was wrong. Pope John Paul II, he apologized to various classes of people for the atrocities that the church had performed. You know, whether it was in South America when they exterminated the Mayan and other civilizations, whether it was their support of slavery or whatever it was. He gave a long list of the sins that the church has committed and he apologized for that. So the mood of the modern times is social inclusion, social justice. And so so it's felt that nobody should unfairly label Islam itself as bad. And although Islamic terrorism is a fact, but still there is this attempt to be politically correct and not ascribe any blame to Islam. Now, if you consider a pendulum, that's one extreme. Now, separate the terrorism's violence entirely from Islam and put them as two separately. The other extreme is, the pendulum goes to the extreme, politically, they say we are being politically incorrect. And such people quote some verses from the Quran and say, this is what Quran says. Just see how violent this religion is. And then these terrorists, they are motivated by the Quran itself. So they label all of Islam as bad. Now, today almost one out of every four persons in the world is a Muslim. So if one fourth of the human population had all been terrorists, the world would have been hellish. Nobody would have been able to live. So to label all Muslims as terrorists. This we may say we are being politically incorrect, but we are just simplistically generalizing things. And it is violence to label anyone as having a particular characteristic just because of their belonging to a particular group. Muslims in different parts of the world, see, religion is one thing that influences people. We are all influenced by various factors. Say, if you see in India itself, it's a different comparison. We say Krishna Bhakti, if we consider. In Krishna Bhakti, in Maharashtra, is different from the Krishna Bhakti in Gujarat. Different in the sense that there's a different language, there's a different focus. Is the Krishna Bhakti, even in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, the way Bhakti was practiced in Bengal is different from the way the Goswami is practiced in Vrindavan, and the way it is practiced in Jagannath Puri. So, the point is, when people behave in particular ways, religion is one factor, that their religious beliefs is one factor that influences them. But there are many other factors also which influence them. So to label people based just on their religion is oversimplification to the level of distortion. So now whenever we are going to approach any people of other religions, any kind of interfaith dialogues are to take place, or interfaith appreciations to take place, there has to be some basic assumptions. The first assumption is that all people are ultimately like us. Now, everybody has their human concerns. Everybody has the struggle for existence. Everybody wants to take care of themselves, take care of their loved ones, do well in life. The basic human concerns are the same for everyone. And people adopt religion because it gives them some sense of meaning and purpose in their lives. So basically, we have the Bhagavad Gita, this is a simple human principle actually. The Bhagavad Gita takes it further deeper and says that, 5.18 says that we should see all living beings equally. Vidya vinaya sampanne brahmane gavyasthini shuri jayva shabhakaicha panditaha samadarshina. The wise person sees not just all human beings, but all living beings equally. And there, the whole scope of living being that I talked about, it talks about there's a Brahmana and there is a Shvapacha. So Brahmana is in the mode of goodness. The Shvapacha, the dog eater, is in the mode of ignorance. But Krishna says, see all of them equally. And even among the animals, the cow is in the mode of goodness. The Vidya is Brahmane Gavi Hastini. The elephant could be said to be the mode of passion. The dog is at the Rudra Vinasampani Brahmane Gavi Hastini Shuni Chaiva Shvapakecha. Yeah. So the dog could be said in the mode of ignorance. So the scope is talked about animals also at various levels. So the point Krishna is making is we have to see everyone as souls. Now that means see the brother in the other. The other, this person is different from me. And we try to demonize that person. This person is like this. This sort of mentality, it's not just for Muslims. You know, it's for everyone. We have it. Now some people say, Sikhs, they are foolish people. Or Marwadis, they are just money-minded people. Or, this kind of people, they are just like this. They are just like that. So, in every community, there is the temptation to categorize other communities and label them simplistically. Now, it's not true. There may be some characters which are similar, but every person is an individual. So, we have to see the spiritual equality among all people. Along with seeing the spiritual equality, we also have to see the material diversity. Now, there is a soul in a tiger, and there is a similar soul in a lion, in a cat. Now, if a cat comes, and if we clap, the cat will run away. Cat will go away. But if the tiger and we clap, we'll go away. Isn't it? There is spiritual equality, but at the same time, at a material level, there is diversity. And there has to be an appropriate response. So, that means that first of all, we need to avoid labels so that we at least recognize spiritually everyone is a soul. Now, practically that soul is like a soul in a tiger's body and a soul in a cat's body. They're going to behave differently. Like that, the soul in different human bodies is shaped by the kind of body-mind complex that they have. So they will behave in different ways. And there has to be an appropriate response accordingly. So now, so the philosophically correct understanding is that actually we all are at our core spiritual beings, but we are covered by the three modes. And depending on what mode a person is in, that person needs to be dealt with appropriately. The person in goodness, person in passion, person in ignorance. The same approach won't work for them. So we have to see that in every religion also, there are different people in different modes. And in general, in the Vedic culture, there are two ways of maintaining order in society. There was the Shastra and there was the Shastra. Shastra is spiritual teaching. Shastra is weapons. So Shastra was used primarily by the Brahmanas to give moral and spiritual instruction by which people would make wise choices. People would understand this is the beneficial thing to do, this is the harmful thing to do. And so Shastra is focused on getting the proper conduct through education. And there will always be people who will not listen to good education, to education, who will not learn by hearing. And now they have to be disciplined. They have to be penalized when required. And for that, there is Shastra. The Kshatriya's work was to act as judges, act as imposers of the law, act as punishers when required, act as fighters. So both approaches are essential for state management. Srila Prabhupada in the Bhagavata purport writes that, that the Brahminical approach, he says, non-violence can be a principle or a strategy. But non-violence cannot be an administrative principle. When a king is ruling, the king cannot be non-violent towards anyone and everyone. If an enemy is attacking, at that time the country has to have the resources to defend, to protect itself. So, where there is military aggression, there has to be countering at the military level, at the martial level also. But at the same time, there also has to be the proper education. It's not that everyone is bad and everyone is to be punished. Those who can be educated and they can be guided, they need to be guided. Those who will not be ready to listen, the appropriate military action has to be taken against them. So when we understand that different people are in different modes, we don't use easy categories. We don't use simplistic labels. We recognize that the reality is nuanced. Now, the Islamic State is the most ferocious of the various terrorist organizations that is there. And now it is a historically alarming phenomena. At the same time, it is reflective of the problem that Islam faces in interacting with modernity. See, it is every tradition has a core which is unchanging, which has to be preserved. But it also has a periphery. It has, Prabhupada said, there's essence and there are principles and there are details. So the principles are the same, the details vary. So every tradition, it has to, its teachers have to recognize what is the core that is to be kept unchanging and what are the details that are to be adjusted. So if we try to, so any way or any kind of religious practice, any kind of religious practicing any religion, it is not about turning back the clock. Turning back the clock means we try imagine an idyllic past and we think that, you know, we have to take all of society back to that idyllic past. So religious practice is not about turning back the clock. It is about turning on the compass. Turning on the compass means all of us have an innate conscience. And with this conscience, when we practice some spiritual practices, we purify ourselves, then our innate conscience guides us properly. So there are timeless principles according to which we are meant to mold our life. And our purificatory practices are meant to harmonize us with those timeless principles. But some people, they try to just turn back the clock. They think to be faithful means we have to replicate the situation, world as it situations as they existed at some primeval time in the past. So now in today's world, there is, as I said, the world is multicultural. Multicultural means we encounter people with so many different faiths. We encounter people with no faiths, people who are atheists. And this can be very confusing for people. What am I meant to live for? What is the purpose of my life? You know, how do I defend my beliefs? How do I rationally explain my practices? So this is a challenge which every religious practitioner has to face. We have to negotiate this challenge, which is an intellectual challenge, that we live in a society which provides us many different challenges intellectually, culturally, for understanding our beliefs and practicing our practices. So this challenge, some people just don't want to take it. So what they do is, it's not that they give up religion, but they just give up thinking about the contemporary world. And so so Islamic State is ultra-literalist. Ultra-literalist means they want to literally go back, take the world back to the 7th century when Muhammad was living. And that's why when they executed people also, it's all for dramatic purposes, but they burned people up. They killed people in the way that they were killing, that people would be killed at the time of war when Muhammad was fighting. So what has happened is, each of the, all the religions, whether it is Christianity, I talk about Hinduism also, it went through a reformation, a renaissance, when it encountered modernity. And then there was an adaptation. Okay, this is the center, this is what we have to practice, this is what has to be adjusted. Islam, unfortunately, has not gone through that renaissance. And because of that, the many Muslims who want some sense of meaning, some sense of purpose, they want pat answers to tough questions. Now, the tough questions don't have any easy answers. So that's why what they do is avoid the intellectual responsibility of understanding what is the essence, what are the details. Just simply, you know, anybody who is not following this, it will be killed. Now, Islamic State actually is seen as a source of great terror and great violence and great killing. But the fact is that Islamic State has killed more Muslims than other people in the world. Because for them, when they are so literalist, they say this is the right interpretation of Quran. And anyone who has any interpretation even of Quran is different from us, you are also heretics. So they have killed people who were, they are Sunnis. So they have killed Shias who were in the mosques worshipping the same God whom they are worshipping. They blew them up. So this is not one religion against another religion. This is simply fanaticism which is there. And fanaticism means, you know, literally it's not just my God, it's not just my teacher, it's not just my book, it is not just my God is the only God, or my book is the only book, or my teacher is the only teacher. It is my interpretation of my God and my teacher and my book is the only way. And anybody has any other interpretation, I said, they are going to go to hell. Not only are they going to go to hell, we will send them there. We'll send them there. So this sort of fanaticism is just, it's not just, it is impossible to live with this kind of fanaticism, not only for people of other religion, but even people of that same religion. So now, what is the solution? Now the extremists who are there, those who are out to do violence, you know, kid gloves won't work for them. Now they have to be combated martially. So whatever is necessary for those who are choosing the path of violence, those who are attacking, they need to be curbed, they need to be punished. But while doing that, we cannot label, so as I talk about the Shastra and Shastra. So where violence is used to attack, then violence is necessary to counter. So violence is a part of the solution. Aggressiveness has to be required for protection, for restriction. But simply, violence is not the solution. So if we demonize all Muslims, if we demonize all of Islam, then that becomes a... we ourselves are not seeing philosophically. We are just succumbing to simplistic labels. So in Islam also, there are moderates. And ultimately, any tradition, if its reformation cannot be done externally. The reformation always has to be done internally. People from within that tradition have to reform themselves. And the moderates in any tradition that are there, if they are empowered, if they are seen as the prominent representatives of that tradition, not the extremists, then the extremists may be the most vocal. They usually the extremists are the people who make the most noise. Either it is noise in terms of speaking or noise in terms of aggressive actions, whichever way it is. But they want to monopolize the voice of their tradition, making themselves as the sole representatives. So the more the rest of the world identifies Islam with the extremists, what happens is, that's what the extremists want. Because they get more attention. And then the moderates, nobody cares for them. And then they get silenced, they get squashed. And then the more and more of the religion gets radicalized. But if the moderates are empowered, that means rather than being suspicious, we give people the benefit of doubt. And we interact with people. And when we interact with people at that time, whether it is Muslims or whichever religion they are, you know, we start with the understanding that ultimately everybody is a human being like us. Everybody is a soul like us. So yesterday I mentioned about how ISKCON has a communications ministry, and we interacted with Christians and they helped us a lot when the brainwashing case came about. So we have been having more than 25 years of Christian Vaishnava dialogue. So just a few months ago I was in Washington DC. So I participated in that dialogue also. It's very broad-minded, tolerant, intelligent, thoughtful Christians, they came together. So like that, ISKCON is also having a Christian Vaishnava Muslim dialogue. And Srila Prabhupada, when he was in Iran, at that time, only once he went to Iran. And while he was there, the devotees were trying to preach over there, and the devotees were talking with Srila Prabhupada. And in the background, the prayers of the Namah started around loudly. And Prabhupada just simply folded his hands and closed his eyes. And he heard the full prayer in a very prayerful manner. And after it was over, Prabhupada opened his eyes. Wasn't that beautiful? The devotees were a little taken aback. One of the devotees said, "But Prabhupada, wouldn't it be better if they were chanting Hare Krishna?" So Prabhupada replied, "Why are you making me sectarian?" He says, "We are worshipping God in our way. They are worshipping God in their way." So we appreciate. So, as I said, individual level, there are many Muslims who are very piously, religiously, they practice their worship of God. And there is the horizontal aspect of any religion, where how it interacts with each other, and there's the vertical aspect. So vertically, there are people who have been elevated to the level of love of God, or who are seeking to connect with God, to devote themselves to God. In fact, there is a Muslim poet, female poet, she says, her prayer is almost like na dhanam na janam na sundari. What Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, she says that, oh Allah, if I am worshipping you for the pleasures of heaven, then keep those pleasures forever away from me. If I am worshipping you to save myself from the fires of hell, let those fires come upon me. But if I am worshipping you, O Lord, just to behold your beautiful form, please don't withhold that form from me. So there are saintly teachers, saints, even the Islamic tradition. And we as spiritual practitioners, we need to see the vertical, the spiritual aspect, and see that this is a path by which people are advancing spiritually. There are people who advance spiritually, and they are using it to raise their consciousness. At the same time, along with that, horizontally, how we deal with it practically, we cannot be simplistically naive, nor can be judgmentally fanatical. We have to be realistic, and the balance of Shastra and Shastra. We work to interact with people, with the moderates. There is a proper, they need to be empowered so that they become the voice of the tradition and they reform the tradition. And with the extremists, they use violence, then they have to be responded to in kind. But when we hear about, sometimes when we see, hear about say Muslims committing, some Islamic terrorists committing some violence here, committing some violence there, it can agitate us a lot. It can make us either angry or fearful or whatever. Now when this happens, we have to always know that actually there is a specific cause of a problem, and there is a essential or core cause of a problem. The specific cause is, okay, these people are committing terrorism because of Islam, in the name of Islam, or this or that. The core cause is what? That Krishna says there are three gates to hell. There is lust, there is anger, there is greed. And violence is ultimately a result of lust, which when frustrated becomes anger. Lust doesn't just mean sexual lust. Lust means any kind of desire. Kama is any kind of strong desire. So Krishna says these three are the gates to hell. So violence is a result of frustrated desire which manifests as anger, which leads to violence. So ultimately what is required is purification. Purification, there are universal failings which all of humanity suffers from. Lust, anger, greed, envy, pride, and illusion. Now when people become angry, they may rationalize their anger in various ways. So they may use, like in Hitler's Germany, they used race. They thought that we Nazis are the best race. And we will destroy all the other races which are unfit. So they used that anger that was there, that was expressed through the rationalization done on racial grounds. More on, in communist Russia, it was based on social grounds. They said, you know, Marx envisioned all of it as a class struggle. And he said, oh, the higher classes are exploiting the lower classes, and therefore the lower classes should rise in revolution and destroy the upper classes. So again, it's anger which got rationalization through the theory of class struggles. So similarly, there are people who have anger, and they may rationalize it through some religious ideology. So the universal human failings are lust, anger, greed, envy, pride, and illusion. And these are the essential causes of suffering, causes of evil. There may be specific causes of evil, that anger may be expressed through religious rationalization as religious terrorism, but the essential cause is the anger that is there. So that can be solved only through purification. So when we are individually purifying ourselves, when we are sharing with others the methods for purifying themselves, when we are setting an example for society of how we can live pure lives, we are doing the best that we can do to be a part of the solution. Srila Prabhupada said that there is no use of crying for world peace unless there is awakening of divine consciousness in the individual. Unless there is awakening of divine consciousness. So, without that, whether if it is not religion, there will be something else which will be the cause of war. So, if there is a specific problem, we may have to deal with it in a specific way. But we have to understand, sometimes we may start feeling that, oh, there is so much, this religious violence is here, there's communal violence there, there's this problem there. I'm just sitting and chanting Hare Krishna. I'm just sitting and discussing Bhagavad Gita. What is the use of this? We have to do something practical. But, you know, if we come in the mode of passion, then when, say, there's a Hindu passion confronts Muslim passion, it will only lead to further explosion. It will lead to aggravation. You know, it is not going to solve problems. When Hindu ignorance combats with Muslim ignorance, it's only going to lead to further problems. Yes, if there is violence, there has to be dealt with appropriately. But the solution in the long run, sustainable solution is more and more people rise at least to the mode of goodness. And more than people rising to the mode of goodness, the people who are in goodness become empowered. They are the people who become the prominent voices of the tradition. And that's when the mode of goodness rises in society, that is when there will be peace. Otherwise, some or other reason will be found and there will be violence because of that. So by practicing bhakti, we are all rising at the very least towards the mode of goodness. And beyond that, towards transcendence. And that's how we all can contribute by addressing the root of the problem. Henry David Thoreau, he said, I'll conclude with this, that he said that one hacking at the root of evil is superior to 1,000 hackings at the shoots of evil. This is an unwanted tree that has grown. We cut the branches. We may cut 1,000 times, but the branches will keep growing again and again. But we hack the root once, the tree will not grow again. So hacking at the root of the tree is what we do through purification. When we purify ourselves, we share the methods of purification with others, we are hacking at the root of the tree. And that is the fundamental solution. So, to summarize, I spoke today about Islam beyond the politically incorrect and the politically correct, the philosophically correct. We discussed the life of Muhammad and how he got the revelation of Quran and how he was both a spiritual teacher and a political leader. And the Quran is a set of revelations which he got at different times, which are combined together after his death. And the Quran is considered, there's no difference between the spirit of the law and the letter of the law. The letter itself is considered to be spirit. And then there, after his departure, there's a violent succession struggle because his rule was not just spiritual, his rule was also political. He had got vast swaths of land. And when the grandson of Muhammad, Hasan Ali was killed, that created an irrevocable rupture between the Shias and the Sunnis. So Shias are the followers of Ali, the Sunnis are the others. And that same, at that time Muhammad used, for example, he talked about jihad. So it can refer to the inner war, it can refer to defensive war, but it's also used to refer to aggressive war. Because they say aggressive war ultimately is also for defending. And then Muhammad used the principle of taqiyya, which is deception for a right cause. So, for a good cause, bad means can also be used. And that principle has been abused by subsequent Muslim leaders. So, individually, Islam is many Muslims practice as a pious way of going closer to God. But socially, socio-politically, many of the leaders use it more as a political search for power than as a spiritual search for truth. So, we discussed about how when today's ethos is of political correctness because social justice, that's the modern ethics theme, and that's why people want to Even when there is Islamic terrorism, it's like the terrorists say, they are completely against the principle of Kshatriya warfare. They attack civilians, they attack people who are unarmed, people who are unalert. So the attempt in political correctness is to ascribe this violence cause to something other than Islam. And this political correctness, it arises because the ethos of postmodernity is social justice, social inclusion. They feel people should not be labeled according to certain categories, and that has been especially used to not label Muslims, and that is true. We cannot label all Muslims as bad, but at the same time, to try to say that the religious terrorism has nothing to do with Islam, that is also not true. To go to the other extreme and to say that all Muslims are terrorists, that is wrong, because all human beings are ultimately like each other. So we all want to get on with our life, and we use religion as a means to make sense of our life while we're going along. And there are Muslims also in various modes, and we need to see with the philosophical vision that there are people in goodness, passion, and ignorance. And people in ignorance, they don't want to take intellectual responsibility for understanding their tradition, separating its principles from its details. So they end up trying to turn back the clock instead of turning on the compass. And that's why the Islamic State is, say, trying to execute people in the same way in which it was done in the past, or other things like that. So the Islamic Renaissance, where it learns to take its core and adapt it to the modern world, that has not happened. And that's why there are the voices of the intolerant voices often are still very prominent. They're not curbed over there. So the way to deal in the Vedic tradition was that there was Brahman and Kshatriya, the spiritual power and the political power. They were separated. In Islam, they are inextricably put together. And that's why the two approaches of dealing with, of maintaining order was Shastra and Shastra. Shastra is wielded by the Kshatriya, Shastra by the Brahmanas. So we also need both. Now we need to have education so that we don't do simplistic categorization. All people are like this, or no people are like this. With education, we have nuanced vision. At the same time, there's violent aggression that has to be countered appropriately. So the extremists have to be combated. Kid gloves won't work with them. But at the same time, we also have to empower the moderates. The tradition, every tradition, it has to reform itself from within, not from without. So labeling Muslims in a particular way is what disempowers the moderates and empowers the extremists. So Prabhupada appreciated the Muslims, their diligence in their worship of God and their recitation of prayers. And we see their spiritual way. They are also raising their consciousness from wherever they are. And at the level of individual interaction, we may have to do the necessary things. But rather than seeing the religion or religious belief as the cause of the problem, we see that ultimately it is the human failings. It is lust, anger, greed, envy, pride, and illusion. They are what cause people to become violent. And they use racist ideology, they use social class theories, or they may use religious scripture to rationalize the violent tendencies. So when we practice bhakti, we share the means of practicing bhakti, we are purifying ourselves and helping others purify themselves of the evil forces within us. And thus, we are hacking at the root of evil. And this is the most efficacious way, that as more and more people come to goodness, and as more and more of the people who are in goodness become more assertive in expressing themselves, then there will be a restoration of sanity and spirituality in society. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. So are there any questions or comments? Yes, Sudhirna. You have a mic there? Yeah. Thank you. So, do all paths lead to the same God? Given that each religion has a different outlook on perfection of life, if goals themselves are different, then does that lead to a hierarchy of religions? But doesn't Krishna say that all paths lead to the same goal? Yes. There is God. Now when God, there is a philosophical conception of God. There is a particular scriptural, or rather there is a philosophical definition of God. There is particular scriptural revelation about God. And there is a cultural conception of God. I don't want to confuse, but I'll make this simple. When we talk about just like India, I can have a political map of India, we can have a topographical map of India, we can have maybe a transport map of India. It's the same India, but it's seen from different perspectives. So same way, when we talk about God, there is a philosophical definition that God is the cause of all causes. The philosophical definition of God is there. Now, within different scriptures, certain aspects of God may be revealed, certain aspects of God may be stressed. Like I told earlier, the Bible itself was more of moral instruction. So the Christians, they integrated biblical theology with, or biblical teachings with, Greek philosophy. So now, if we consider the philosophical definition of God as is taught in the various religious traditions, that definition is more or less the same. All religions talk about God as the source of everything. All religions talk about God as the sustainer of all of existence. So largely, there is tremendous similarity between various religions as far as the philosophical definition of God is concerned. Now beyond that, there is a scriptural revelation. In each scripture, God is revealed with certain details. Or certain emphasis. And then there is the cultural conception of God. See, there is Bhagavad Gita, say, that tells about Krishna as God. But there are millions of people who may follow Bhagavad Gita, and each of them may have their own conception of what the Bhagavad Gita teaches. They may have their own conception of what Krishna is. So there is the cultural conception that people have. So there is one God that is talked about in, say, in the Bible, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita. But the followers of the Bible, Quran, Bhagavad Gita, they may not have the same conception of the same one God. The God of the terrorists, here I'm using the word God in double quotes, the God of the terrorists is not necessarily the same as the God of the transcendentalists. The God of terrorists, they may say we are following the Quran only, but their God is simply a super powerful being who hates the people whom they hate. You know, their God is simply a projection of their ego. So that's why when we say, do all paths lead to the same end, or do all religions talk about the same goal? In terms of philosophical definition, yes. The God that is talked about in the theistic traditions of the world is the same. But in terms of the cultural conceptions of the followers, they may have different conceptions. And depending on how, basically there's a journey from self-centeredness to God-centeredness. That is the essence of developing a relationship with God. From, you know, what can I do for, what can God do for me, to what I can do for God. That's the mood of service. So now, to the extent that they are developing that, they're advancing. So ultimately, the various religions are meant to help people arrive at love of God. But specifically, what conception who has, what conception the particular religious texts are teaching, what particular conception the teachers of that religious text are teaching to its followers, that will vary. So as the Gita says, mama vartamanu vartante manushyaha partha sarvashaha. That all people are on my path. So there is the path of raising one's consciousness upwards, and all people are on that one path. But they are at different levels or different places on that path. And some of them are going further on the path, some of them are going backwards on the path also. So it's not necessary that just because somebody is practicing a religion, they're necessarily going up. Sometimes if religion itself becomes a tool for increasing one's ego, increasing one's pride, increasing one's arrogance, then that person may not be going closer to God. So it has to be, we have to see based on individual consciousness. So essentially or ultimately, yes, all religions are meant to help people to move toward the same one ultimate destination. But in terms of the individual cultural conception of that destination, there may be variety. And based on that variety, people may or may not move all the way along the destination. So all paths lead to the same goal, but all paths may not lead people all the way to the same goal, because their own conception may be somewhat different. And if that conception now is different, when I talk about all paths, I'm not talking about atheism, I'm talking about theistic religions and their proper practitioners. So it depends on case, individual to individual. Even within Krishna consciousness also, it's not that just because we're chanting Hare Krishna, we are all going back to Krishna. We also have to purify ourselves. We have to develop love for Krishna. So there is nominal affiliation with a particular religion, particular organization, particular book. And there is all-round dedication to what is taught over there. So when there's dedication, then gradually we may have a particular conception, but if that conception is not correct, that conception will get corrected. And we will move towards clearer and clearer understanding. Vidyate hridaya granthe shidyante sarvacha samshayaha. So he says that as we keep practicing the process of purification, then the doubts go away. The clear understanding, Bhagavat Tattva Vijnana Mukta Sangasa Jayate, Bhagavat Tattva, the understanding of the truth about God that emerges. So this is what the Bhagavatam is teaching the verses. That's actually the universal trajectory for purification. So different people may follow it in different ways. But if people become purified, then whatever conceptions they may have about God, if they are not the precisely correct conception, those conceptions will get purged out. And then their understanding of God will match with the revelation which is given in the scriptures. And if their revelation is not fully given, the revelation also is partial, then whatever is not there, that will be provided by God from within. Yoga kshemam vahamyaham. I will provide you what you lack. So Krishna says. So that way, ultimately, if people have the intention to develop love for God, they will be guided. So it's not just which path one is following, but with what intention, with what intensity, with how much intelligence one is following that path. That will determine whether one will get all the way to the destination. Yes, ma'am. You had a question? Yeah, Mike? Yes.
Thank you for my student. You were speaking about this postmodern era and social justice. If you see this intellectual elites and Indian lefty, they are very sympathetic toward Islam when it comes to terrorism. But the same people, those who have this postmodern idea, when it comes to Vedic tradition or Hinduism, they blame entire Hinduism as being caste system. So, how to deal with them? What we can do? And why just follow this double standard approach towards Hinduism?
Okay. So if there is the ethos of social justice among the postmodern, then why is it that the leftist scholars, they separate Islam from terrorism, but they don't do the same with Hinduism? They blame, say, the caste system itself as bad. They, because of, say, caste discrimination, they blame all of Hinduism itself as bad. See, in general, the postmodern idea of social inclusion is that the minorities are always favored. So if you consider the Christians in America, they feel that the media always discriminates against them, that they always highlight the fringe elements of Christianity which are doing some extreme things. And the good that Christianity is doing, they don't talk about it. So the whole idea is that it is assumed that that which is in majority, no, they will already have power. And that which is in minority, they will be persecuted, they will be sidelined. So the ethos of social justice, they focus on their idea is to empower the minorities. Now, having said that, it is also true that many Hindus have not taken responsibility for studying and presenting their tradition appropriately. Now, many of the most prominent scholars of Hinduism in the world are actually not Hindus. Now, if you consider most of the textbooks on Hinduism, which are written, which are considered like the authority textbooks on Hinduism, they are written by Western scholars. Now, why is that? Because Hindus have not entered into that academic study of religion so much. So, you know, if we don't explain who we are, others will explain who we are. So, people have to gain some understanding. Especially in the Western world, this matters a lot. Because in India, Hinduism is a lived religion. But in the West, yes, people may meet some Hindus. But you know, if people want to know something about Hinduism, they will go to Wikipedia. Or they will look at some encyclopedia. And those are written by academic scholars. So what has happened is, if we don't speak for ourselves, then people want to have some knowledge. And then they will go to academic scholars. So there are a good number of devotee scholars who have also entered into academics, especially in the West. And they are at least changing the conception of Hinduism. Because in the mainstream, conception of Hinduism was, Hinduism means impersonalism. That was their idea. Because most of the prominent modern Hindu teachers were impersonalists. So they've changed that, and that there is a very strong personalist tradition in the Hinduism also. That is now being, that is at least being established now. So we need to work towards presenting our perspective in the practitioner's perspective. Not in a sentimental or fanatical way, but in a rational way. So sentimental way means, you know, everything the religious is good, makes me feel so good, it is so nice. Fanatical means, you dare to blaspheme my God, I'll kill you. You dare to criticize my form of worship, I'll have your book banned. Now that sort of approach only alienates people today. That makes people label us as fanatics. So there has to be a rational presentation of the tradition and rational, non-fanatical presentation which will be intelligible to the mainstream people. So things are changing gradually. See, basically, once scholars adopt a particular view, it's very difficult for them to change their view because their whole career depends on their view then. So scholars, once they adopt a view, they're not likely to change it. I read an article in one scientific journal. They said that science progresses one funeral at a time. What it means is that if there is one prominent scientist who has got one particular idea, then that scientist is maybe the head of department or the editor of a big journal. Then if somebody has another idea, you just can't propagate that. Because that scientist controls the fund, that scientist controls the journals, what gets published in the journals. So it's only when that scientist dies. After that, scientists who have opinions different from that scientist, they can present their theories. The same applies in the study of religion also. So that's also an academic field. So if we as, if say, those who are practitioners, they also can give a scholarly presentation of the tradition, it may not change things immediately. But gradually the scholar, the traditional perspective, the insider perspective, the practitioner's perspective of the tradition will also be heard, it will be included. So it's more because we neglected to do that, so we now have to accept others' depiction of ourselves. And as we start doing that more and more, then gradually the misrepresentation of our tradition that is there in the mainstream, that will gradually change. Does it answer your question?
Last question.
Yeah.
The mainstream Islamic idea about the shirk is that it is a biggest sin. The biggest sin in Islam is bigger than that is sin. Allah can forgive all sins, including killing, but He cannot forgive the sin of shirk. This is the mainstream idea. And this moderate leaders, which were highly elevated, like our Prime Minister, Rao Indisha, they are not their idols and they don't even consider them as Muslims. So, how they have this mainstream idea, how people of other religions and they can coexist in this world?
So, if Muslims consider that idolatry is the greatest of all sins, and if this is the mainstream idea, then how can they coexist with other religions? Yes, that is where the reformation is required. So, we have to understand that every tradition will need... Tradition is not just a matter of connection with the past. A living tradition is connected with the past, but it's also connected with the present. And that connection with the present is what makes the tradition relevant. Connection with the past makes the tradition faithful. That is the fidelity of the tradition. Connection with the present requires flexibility. If there's no flexibility, then sooner or later the tradition becomes simply a museum exhibit. And it just becomes extinct. So there is, as far as the moderate Muslims are concerned, they do recognize that there are people who are going to have different beliefs from ours. And because we live in a multicultural world, we cannot impose our beliefs on them. So now to what way they themselves reconcile the concept, the worship of the deities, the worship of images, that is up to them. So many Christians reconcile it by, they talk about the Sagun Brahma and Nirgun Brahma, and they say, okay, this form is worshipped and there is a formless also. And then they find it that, okay, this is something which is for some people, this is for bhaktas, this is the form, but for the gyanis, there's no form. That's how they reconcile it. So each tradition will have to find its own way to reconcile the beliefs of some other tradition which don't agree with it. So that is the whole challenge of being connected with the current world. So those who cannot stick, those who are not ready to connect like that, either they will become irrelevant, or if they become dominant, then others have to leave from there because they cannot live. They cannot live in harmony with others. So we as devotees, we need to focus on, there are significant differences between the deity and the idol. The first and foremost is that there is a clear description of the form of God given in our scriptures. And it is based on that description of the form that there's a depiction. So in that sense, this is not an imagination, this is not a concoction. This is a replication as per the description given in the scripture. So that's why what was applicable at that time is not applicable now. The condemnation of idol worship that was done at that time, that is not applicable now. And I was at this Christian Vaishnava dialogue, and there one Christian scholar, he spoke that he had come to one of our ISKCON temples, and he stayed there for a few days, and he had his own seminars and other things for other people he had organized. And he was leaving. He stayed for about 10 days. When he was leaving, dude is asking, how was your stay over here? So it was very challenging. What do you mean challenging? Now normally we are very hospitable to guests. We take care of them. So what did you find challenging? He said, you know, every morning when I would come and see you doing your worship to the deities, you know, I had been taught to believe that this is satanic.
that this is worship of the Satan, but I could see that there is so much intense devotion over here. So I just could not deny the devotion. So how do I reconcile this genuine devotion with my conception that this is worship of a false god? So that was very challenging for me.
So he's honest enough to admit that.
But the point is that if even people who have certain cultural conceptions, if they interact with genuine practitioners, then they may say that, this is wrong. But it's like giving the earlier metaphor of disease. You know, somebody may say, the allopathic doctor says, Ayurveda is bogus. It doesn't work. It cannot work. But then you may say, this prescription is wrong, but the patient is cured. Now you can see patient is cured means actually the person has developed genuine devotion for God. So the person has actually been cured. So if you see that, then you start thinking, you know, maybe my idea that this prescription is wrong is itself wrong. There's something right about this prescription. So Ayurvedic medicine may not make sense from the allopathic perspective. But if a patient is cured, you cannot deny the cure of the patient. The patient's restoration of health. So like that, if Muslims, they may have certain conceptions, but if they interact with bhaktas who are worshipping the deity and who are devoted to God, who are spiritually advanced, then that spiritual advancement, it's self-evident. It will be seen. And then their conceptions will be challenged. And then they will have to come to their own reconciliation that, okay, that condemnation of idolatry that I was talking about, that applies at that time. It does not necessarily have to apply now to all forms of worship that are done in some other tradition. That's how they can come to reconciliation. Okay? Thank you. Hare Krishna. At what point was the slaughter of cows introduced in Islam? Are there moderate Muslims who do not support the cow slaughter? Yes. See, the Arabs who became Muslims, that is a place where it was arid. It's a desert. So there's not much possibility for agriculture over there. Naturally, meat was a staple food. And within that, slaughter of various animals was there. So there is some principle of like regulation that you should not kill pigs. So the point is not why specifically pigs. The point is that there is some regulation. Although you can eat meat, but there's regulation. So, as I said, there is a universal principle of regulation, there is a universal principle, there are specific details. So, the principle of regulation is there, the specific detail of what to regulate, when to regulate, that can vary from tradition to tradition. Now, within the tradition, if you move forwards, it is not a core principle that, say, an animal has to be slaughtered, like they have bakri, or they have the idea that we have to, as a religious principle, kill animals. Kill cows or whatever. Now, there are many places in where Islam is a mainstream religion and so much cattle is not available at all. So Malaysia, Indonesia, you know, it's not that anybody who does not kill an animal on the particular holy day, they are not Muslims. It's not a cardinal, it's not a central principle of Islam. So, to some extent, For the Britishers, they followed the policy of divide and rule. So there was definitely antipathy towards Hindus, which was there among Muslims. But it is more of that after living for many generations, if you see the 1857 rebellion that happened, as Hindus and Muslims were united together in fighting against the Britishers. So there, Hindus and Muslims had more or less arrived at some kind of uneasy peace. No, it is not a relaxed peace. It is uneasy peace, but his peace was there. But because of political manipulation, by the British, they wanted to, they had this policy of divide and rule. And for because of that policy, they started stoking religious passions. So certain certain practices within Islam, which were fringe practices, non-essential practices, they were portrayed as if they are central practices. And that's how cow slaughter started becoming more central. And then again, Muslims also started demanding. When you stop somebody from doing something, then they start demanding, now I will do it. So that's how the whole thing became very aggressive. And now it has become like a flashpoint. But there are, there is one Muslim scholar who's written a book called Vegetarianism in Islam. And he talks about verses from the Quran where Muhammad is encouraging, from not from the Quran, I think from the Hadith, is encouraging people to actually, his followers, to settle in a place where they can cultivate land and live without meat. And further, if we consider the overall tenor, it is not that slaughtering animals is like a central principle of Islam. So, once a religion becomes mixed with politics, or religion is used as a political tool, then often the most provocative practices, the most provocative beliefs are highlighted. And then they are presented as if defending them is protecting that religion. And then that leads to a lot of unnecessary aggression. There are many, Muslims even now who engage in cow slaughter, But there are many Muslims who also recognize that, you know, maintaining a cow is useful. So it's not that, there is economics, there is politics, and there is religion over there. So from the economic perspective, if cow protection, if cow care is made into economically sustainable activity, then it is not that there will be slaughter of cows even when it's economically sustainable. So we have to develop the resources for tapping the things coming from a cow, such as gomut, such as the various gifts that a cow gives. And when the taking care of a cow becomes economically viable, it is shown to be economically viable, economically sound, then it will substantially go down. The slaughter of cows will go down substantially. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Prabhuji, once I was actually...
Yeah, please speak.
Once I was discussing, debating with one of the Protestant extremists, and he actually was a Hindu, he got converted. He is a Gujarati, he was converted in Protestant. So, he was saying that, you know, Skalki avatar is Jesus coming on horse. He is not Krishna, he is not Vishnu. He is Jesus is coming on horse. And so why do they claim that they have same references of Jesus coming on horse and, you know, killing everyone and, you know, again re-establishing dharma? So is it Krishna or is it Jesus? I mean, I'm confused with that. So when they claim that it's Jesus, not Krishna, the Kalki avatar.
Okay. So, when Christians claim that, now that prediction that Kalki is going to come, they say that is the second coming of Jesus, and that Jesus will come on a horse. So it is not Krishna coming; it is Jesus coming. So see, every religion has to deal with the challenge of how to penetrate into the thought world of people who are following other religions. And they all come with their own ideas. So now Muslims say, Muslims accept the fact that Jesus is also a prophet. They don't accept that Jesus was the only begotten Son of God. They say he's one of the prophets. And they also accept that Jesus is going to come again. But they say, when Jesus will come again, he will extol the glories of Muhammad. So, every tradition tries to appropriate the imagery, the prophecy of other traditions to serve its own purposes. That's simply the way traditions try to penetrate into other traditions. So now Kalki is, as I said, one of the Dashavatars. So we could say that Krishna, it is the Supreme Lord who is going to come again. That's what the scriptures tell us. But they every religion will try to do this. This is simply the way that they try to penetrate into the thought world of the other religions. And those who are simpletons, they get carried away by this. But those who are intellectually sharp, they see this as simply as a strategy for misappropriation. Like I said, you have Jesus Sahasranam or you have Christo Upanishad. This is simply an attempt to use the imagery, use the tools of another tradition for propagating one's own tradition. Answer? Does that answer your question? Okay, thank you. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you, yesterday you were mentioning about Christian missionaries, the way they propagate Christianity all over and the fierce way in which they go ahead, the missionary spirit. I was just drawing a correlation to how the Britishers actually colonized India. If I am not wrong, one of the understanding which I draw is that when they entered India, they saw that there were many kingdoms and there were so many communities culturally. We were so much diverse and there were so many divisions. So what they tried to do is that they tried to find the fault lines between each kingdom, and that is how they tried to percolate and eventually take over. Now even though they have left, but still the impressions are still there. When we look at Christianity, the way they operate, they are also doing something similar to what I could correlate in terms of colonization, wherein they try to portray that they are assimilating as being one amongst us, but they are eventually acting like a cancer within the body. And the thing is that I would want to know from you how we can checkmate this religious conversion which is happening. I mean, I'm not against people who will organically take to some other religion if they find transcendence in that, but this kind of brainwashing which is happening. So how can we as people, because see, we have today the media, we have the intelligence, and we have resources at our disposal by which we can ensure that if individuals want to do some other religion, they do it naturally. But it should not be at the cost of some way by which people are being lured to take up that procedure.
Yeah.
And also, if I can just continue, also I would want to know that as Hindus, we are various communities. What can be done at a central stage, wherein the thinkers and the leaders of different Hindu communities come together, establish some kind of interoperability, wherein, you know, because when we are in ISKCON, we are within ourselves as community. We do not go to other communities, to Hindu communities, to see what is happening there. So this is what Christians have tried to explore, wherein now they are trying to see that, okay, we are a kingdom here, so with us, they will operate in a certain way. With others, they will operate. Wherever they find loopholes, they will percolate. So how can we make our foundation so strong that we ensure that this is being checkmated?
So, the Britishers, when they conquered India, they exploited the fault lines among the Indian kingdoms. And the Christian mission is also doing something similar. So how can we counter the Christian conversions, especially those which happen through allurements? And can Hindu forces be united to counter this? There are two different things over here when we talk about conversions. One is that we can see religion as a marketplace. Whoever markets the best, their products sell. So Christians are marketing their product. Hindus are not marketing their product. In fact, you know, although the caste system, and it's especially with the metropolitan ethos coming up, the caste discrimination has gone down substantially, still it is there. Now, even now, in many temples, people from the lower caste are not allowed to enter the temple also. So naturally, if the people want to have some connection with something religious, something higher, something spiritual, you say, why should I belong to a religion which discriminates against me, which doesn't allow me to enter the temple also? Why not I belong to, I take up some other religion where I am respected as a member of the community? Now, whether they are actually respected in the same way as other, that's a different question. But the thing is that many times in our tradition, instead of presenting the tradition attracting people, we often do things which alienate people who are practitioners of our own tradition. So the caste system as it exists today is a great evil. And it needs to be countered. And it, the countering is not simply by making reservations. That reservation is actually increasing the fault lines because it is leading to some kind of reverse discrimination. There is more of a spiritual education by which we see the commonality of the, especially the cultural commonality of all followers of the Vedic tradition. So to the extent we can present ourselves best, to that extent people will be attracted. And if we don't present, people will go away. Somebody who presents better, people will be attracted to them. So it's a religious marketplace. We have to do the marketing well. And we are not doing that well to a large extent. Second thing is, as far as exploiting fault lines is concerned, which they are doing, yes. See, at a practical level, there are strategies which every religion forms. A religious tradition, every organization forms. Okay, how do we reach this kind of people? And if these are the differences between these people, yes, we will tap them. So that's not necessarily evil. It's just an operational principle. So, yes, sometimes they may execute it in evil ways. They may do some diabolical things at that time. But it's just a way religious... All religions have a spiritual core. But there is economics involved in it. There is politics involved in it. There is sociology involved in it. There is human ego involved in it. So all that comes into the picture also. And we cannot expect any religion to be purely spiritual. All the other factors will come into the picture. The important thing is, all those factors need to be subordinate so that the spirituality goes on. Sometimes the other factors itself become too prominent. And then the spiritual flow gets choked. So now with respect to uniting of Hindus, generally speaking, if you see, as I said, that among the Protestants themselves, there are more than 50,000 denominations. So even if you consider Christianity in India, then the Christians are not united. Now they have sometimes fierce conflicts among each other. So it's just that different people have different faith conceptions. And based on that, there will be differences. So, but still, to some extent, because they have a commonality. Now, the present Pope Francis is trying to reconcile with the Orthodox Church to some extent, reconcile with the Protestants also to some extent. So now, it depends on what the focus is. Within the broad Hindu tradition, if we see, ideologically or philosophically, there are differences. Some people are personalists, some people are impersonalists, some people follow this kind of belief, have this kind of belief. So if you focus on philosophy, there will be a lot of differences. If you focus on culture, there will be a lot of commonalities. Now all the people who are Hindus, they have certain common cultural elements. You know, that is, say, they worship, venerate the deity, they take care of the cows. There is some respect for the announced order. There is respect for the Vedas. So if we focus on the cultural features, then there is possibility of coming together. Ultimately, it is only at the spiritual level that any kind of sustainable relationship can be developed. So now, rather than considering ISKCON as one monolithic organization, no, it is not, yes, when Srila Prabhupada started ISKCON, he focused primarily on the spiritual aspect, you know, raising people's consciousness to the spiritual level. At the same time, as ISKCON grows bigger and bigger, there will be different devotees with different interests. And if some devotees feel inspired to network in a particular way, then they can do that. So some devotees, say, may be very scientifically inclined. They may focus on the field of science and spirituality and try to interact that way. Some people may be more inspired with social causes. So that would mean that they can get involved in more social causes. Some devotees may be inspired more by humanitarian causes. Srila Prabhupada encouraged even devotees who wanted to get into politics. Prabhupada started a political party called In God We Trust in America. But then when the devotees said that, they found that actually to get into politics requires a lot of money. And they asked Prabhupada to fund the political party. So Prabhupada said, no, that this, the resources that we have got from book distribution, from this, we are going to use that for sharing Krishna consciousness directly. But Prabhupada said, Prabhupada, don't you support us? You only asked us to start this party. Don't you support us? Yes, I support you, but don't ask me for money. Prabhupada was very clear that the primary resources of the Krishna consciousness movement should be used for sharing spiritual consciousness, for helping people to raise their consciousness spiritually. Because very few organizations are doing this. But that doesn't mean that other causes cannot be done. Within the broad spiritual framework, if somebody feels inspired to serve Krishna in a particular way, they find like-minded people and they network with them and they can spread that way. So we can see Krishna consciousness like a broad umbrella. And within that, there can be smaller umbrellas with smaller causes which take things forward. Does that answer your question? Thank you very much. Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhaktivinda ki, Jai Gaur Bhaktivinda.
Apparently we would like to have more question answers, but